Are you tired? Are you frequently in a state of fatigue? It might surprise you to learn that your cellular health begins to decline as early as 25 years of age. As you age, your cell membranes start to become like Swiss cheese. This cellular damage is the primary cause of biological aging. It could be the root of your fatigue. But there's a breakthrough supplement that's scientifically proven to repair and renew your body's cells. NT-Factor Lipids. NT-Factor lipids are identical to the phospholipids found in your cellular membranes. NT-Factor is the only solution proven and published in medical journals to repair those dead spots in the membranes. If you're older, it can give you back the vitality, focus, and cognitive function of people half your age. And if you're young, this is the tool to optimize your energy production. I've been using NT-Factor for years and prescribe it for my patients. Learn more about the NT-Factor line of nutritional formulas at your favorite health food store or online retailer, or to order direct, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly rundown of questions that you send to us at questions@drhoffman.net. With me today is Layla Mutin, because she joins me each week for our Q&A with Layla segment. Among the most popular, if not the most popular, of all our weekly podcasts, because you never know what you're going to hear about on Q&A with Layla. We cover a diverse array of issues which are determined by your interests as listeners. Questions@drhoffman.net, the place for questions. Also comments. Comments are welcome too. So how you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I'm kind of glad that January is over, because it's kind of like a draggy month. You know, it's kind of cold, gray.
I'm glad the snow this morning I saw out the window turned to rain pretty quickly.
Well, we're one of our very unusual stretches with no snow in New York.
I haven't had to shovel the walk in front of my house.
Yeah, so, nice. You know, but it's nonetheless, it's sort of dark and gloomy.
Yeah.
And it'd be preferable to be in a warmer climb.
Sure.
So, which is actually where I'm headed in a couple of weeks. I'm going to spend a few days cycling in Death Valley, California.
Wow.
Where it's part of a, you know, group. Mm-hmm. It's an organized group. And it's going to be warm and sunny.
Fantastic.
It's in a place called Furnace Creek. But this time of year, Furnace Creek gets up to a high of about 70.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah. So
that's lovely.
It's a
good place. It's a great time to get away in February.
Yeah. I need a little light infusion.
Yes.
And it'll be a way to keep my training going in winter. So, all right. So we're going to take questions momentarily, but I just wanted to comment on this story. U.S. will trail other rich nations in life expectancy by 2030. It is an interesting story, because actually, you know, we tend to think of us making continuous progress in our fighting against diseases and extending lifespan. And that really was the prospect until a few years ago, when all of a sudden we started going backwards in life expectancy. And so just to give you an idea, the country that has one of the longest life expectancies is South Korea. By 2030, the projection is for men, it'll be 84
degrees.
Degrees. I'm already in Death Valley.
Yeah, you are.
It'll be 84 years for men in South Korea, but for women, it'll be, and this is the normal life expectancy, over, for the first time in human history, it'll be topping 90. It'll be 90.82,
wow.
Almost 91.
Terrific.
For women in South Korea. On the other hand, comparatively, the United States lags significantly for men. By 2030, the life expectancy will be under 80 for men. So if for you men who are over 80, you're already beating the odds. And for women, it'll be a mere 83 years of age. Fully seven years less.
Wow.
Other comparable countries, France, men live a little longer, 82 years. They still smoke Gauloises. They ride around on those crazy mopeds. Also, women, 88 and a half years old by 2030 will be the life expectancy. Japan, mm-hmm. For men, 83, and for women, 88 and a half.
Wow.
So we're not doing very well.
Or not.
And if you think it's just about North America, well, Canada, 84.
For men?
For men. Mm-hmm. 87 for women. That's the projection. And so if we compare life expectancies of the countries with the highest life expectancies, right now it's Japan, soon to be surpassed by Korea. Of the top 20, mm-hmm. the U.S. isn't on there at all.
Not the top 20.
So countries that are surpassing the United States, Japan, Switzerland, Singapore, Australia, Spain, Iceland... Iceland's doing pretty well. I was just there. Mm-hmm. It's a harsh climate.
Switzerland.
They eat a lot of fish. Uh-huh. Italy, Israel, France, Sweden at number 10, Korea, Canada, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, a lot of European countries, Malta, New Zealand, Austria, Ireland, UK. And I guess, you know, way down there somewhere is Russia. Russia is very, they actually have a negative population growth because the deaths are out exceeding the births. There's a lot of birth control and abortion.
Yes.
There's now war casualties, but even before that, there was a demographic trend towards early death, especially among men mm-hmm. who drink and smoke a lot.
Yeah.
And so that is a problem. So here's the interesting correlation. Of all the major countries in the world, which country do you think has the highest percentage of total adult population aged 15 years and older who are technically obese? Answer?
I would say America.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
Yep. United States.
And that's what's contributing to our...
Where the percentage is 40%. And that is based on a BMI of over 30.
Yes.
And a
40%.
40%. So I just calculated my BMI. My BMI is in the healthful range. It's like 23.75. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it? 22 to 25 is considered good?
Yeah, 22, 24.9.
Okay. So actually, there was a time where I was a little bit more bulked up when I was doing a lot of weightlifting. I would have qualified as on the cusp of overweight.
Well, that's why we don't like BMI.
BMI is not that good.
No.
So BMI for like a football player, a linebacker, bodybuilder is going to... Even like somebody with minimal body fat is not going to be good. But since this is overall population, we're not talking fit individuals. It's pretty applicable. So United States at 40%. Then the runner-up, the penultimate country,
mm-hmm.
I'm using that word correctly finally, is Chile with 34.4. So it actually 6 percentage points differentiate U.S. from its nearest competitor in terms of obesity. Mexico is up there. There's a lot of obesity in Mexico. They've done major things there. They've tried to restrict the sale of soft drinks. The Mexicans love their soft drinks and they're drinking calories. New Zealand is up there at 32. Of interest is Japan. What do you just take a wild guess. What do you think the obesity rate is in Japan? And keep in mind that there are a few sumo wrestlers there. They're very... intentionally.
Well, that's a whole,
that's a culture. But it's not like, you know, sumo wrestlers are...
Obesity rate?
Obesity rate in Japan.
14%.
Okay. Try again.
Up or down?
Down.
Oh, 12%.
It's an astonishing 4.2%.
Oh, my goodness.
How about that?
In Japan?
Yeah, how about that?
Wow.
For some reason, I don't have statistics on China, which is the world's most populous country here. I wonder where they're at.
They're being secretive. They're locked down. They're not showing themselves.
Right. It's like nobody's dying of COVID and nobody's obese. A country that I just visited, Lithuania, is doing pretty good. It's 16.6. I looked at the people there. They were pretty fit-looking people. And, you know, especially the older people in the cold, cold weather, you know, the snow.
They were walking up and down steps, you know, crossing bridges over highways and, you know, going shopping with heavy shopping bags.
You know what I'm reminded of? 15 years ago, you and I were talking about how this generation of children, 15 years ago, are going to die sooner than their adult parents.
That whole thing.
And the obesity epidemic has everything to do with it.
Right.
The obesity percentage rate, I believe, then was, what was it, 28%? Maybe 30 or something?
I see that in my family because my grandfather, who grew up in great deprivation and hardship in Poland, you know, he was born in 1899, and, you know, he actually had rickets because he was short and he had bow legs.
Uh-huh.
And so obviously he had some nutritional compromise. He ended up dying at 101. His son died at 60. His daughter, my mother, died at around 82.
Wow.
And I'm seeing this in other branches of families, is that, you know, you'll get often these hearty people who are survivors, you know, for whether they're from Eastern Europe or whether they're from, you know, other parts of the world where there was deprivation. And if you survived, and there was certainly a challenge to survival, you can do pretty well. And their children coming to America and experiencing prosperity, there's a higher toll. Have you noticed that in your family? Because you actually, your family comes from overseas originally.
Yeah, it's from the Crimea.
The old country, right.
The old country, right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. What's interesting is we're taller. My generation, my cousins,
obviously taller.
All of that were taller.
I'm taller than my father, and in turn, he was taller than my grandfather.
Yeah. I think I'm an inch shorter than my father, for example.
Uh-huh.
So something like that. But
right.
Yeah.
But in terms of life expectancy, I mean, certainly there's there are two twins in another branch of my family, and one lived to 96 and one lived to 102. And one of their shortly thereafter, one of their sons died at 75. He was 75, and he suffered from diabetes and, you know,
the Western diet.
Right. So we're seeing, and look, we're
diet also seeing prosperity in their diet.
We're also seeing an increase in deaths of despair, you know, which are drug and alcohol related, and suicide and violence, you know, crime is taking its toll. And then COVID took a little bit of a toll.
Yeah.
But
we're seeing a lot more fentanyl deaths too now.
Yeah. But we can't attribute this all to COVID because it was happening before COVID.
Right. Yes, it was happening before COVID. But I just find it very concerning that we score so way below number 20.
Right.
In life expectancy.
And here's the other thing. I bet if there's another chart that we could overlay on that is expenditure per capita for medical care.
Oh.
And I think that we are way ahead of the world and we're not getting bang for our buck in terms of extending life. And
So what does that mean? Stop seeing doctors. I don't think so.
Well, there's that old adage of, you know, that, and I think it came from a study in a country where they had a doctor's strike, a prolonged doctor's strike. And what they found is there was a significant decrease in mortality during that time.
Oh.
But maybe that was because there weren't so many heroic interventions that killed people.
Right.
You know, like.
Like, yes.
Medical mayhem. But here we can't. One of the things that we do a good job with, though, is we keep sick people alive longer in America.
True.
I think your chances of doing better with a serious medical condition that you might get earlier in America than in another country, you do better. So we are sort of prolonging the survival, sort of the illness period.
Yeah, we're survival of the sickest.
Right.
Rather than survival.
Right.
Yeah, that's very disheartening. And the obesity, I can't believe that number, 40%.
Mm-hmm.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just around that issue is, you know, that study that we talked about that wasn't a study, it was actually a position paper of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AAP, which is recognizing that there's a tremendous problem with childhood obesity. Okay, good. I spend, you know, like, it's a very long paper, like, you know, hundreds of pages.
I read some of the excerpts, yeah.
And what they do, they talk about very intensive lifestyle intervention.
Yeah.
Which they talk about, and then they say, but yeah, but you know, it's expensive, it's impractical, it doesn't really work.
Exactly. And they're saying 13-year-olds should be medicated
right
for it, and even bariatric surgery. Age 13. Wait
right,
a minute.
Right.
They're still growing.
Right.
They're still growing.
Right. And we don't know what the effects of these medications are on adults, much less growing children long term.
Yeah.
So, but there was like a pushback against that, you know, from various people for taking our perspective. It was like, you know, maybe this is too extreme. Like, why don't you try like really effective lifestyle intervention, like very low carb diets?
Yeah.
That could really make a difference. Okay. Well, there's pushback from some people. I read an article in the New York Times. The pushback was, this whole thing is like stigmatizing overweight people, and we should have more, you know, we're creating like a whole category of people who are marginalized and stigmatized, and it's a form of, you know, okay, I get that. And I think that one of the segments of our population that is most discriminated against in a way that is tacitly accepted are the overweight individuals. You know, just by us talking about it, it's like making people feel terrible. But we still have to
talk about it.
But we're talking about it from a health standpoint.
Exactly.
From a cosmetic standpoint.
We're not passing judgment. Yeah, yeah. We're trying to help.
Yeah. So it really is, I mean, if it were one thing, it'd be like, oh, you know, you're fat, you're ugly, but it doesn't have any health consequences. Well, then I get it. It's like, you know.
If it has no health consequences, be fat and ugly. Go for it. If there are no health, it's the health consequences we're concerned about.
Right. I mean, you know.
Not how they look or, you know, that's terrible. What's going on? It's like we're afraid to offend anybody.
So it's ridiculous. Like what they're saying is like we should just accept this, you know, the fat acceptance movement. I'm really concerned about that because that's a whole movement where it seeks to normalize overweight. You know, it's like underwear ads with people who are very overweight.
Yes.
I mean, look, it's a good way to sell plus size underwear.
Sure.
And, you know, that they make look. Thank God there's that option because otherwise people would have to sew together their own underwear, you know. I'm glad that they have that option.
Of course,
you know?
Of course, yeah.
But whatever.
They're looking at so-called real people, but don't forget that these real people, there are health consequences to their
weight.
There simply is. We can't get around that.
Yeah.
We can't get around that.
So it's a complex societal issue, and, you know, we're going to have to tackle that if we're going to move forward in this country. I mean, we think of all the threats to the progress in America, and I think this is huge. What's happening to our food supply, our lack of routine physical exercise.
Yes.
And the gap between the haves and the have-nots. People on superb diets, they shop at Whole Foods, they exercise with personal trainers, you know, and they're like in fantastic shape versus the vast majority of the populace who are poor diets and very little physical activity.
Very little physical activity. Maybe living in food deserts, although now with delivery and such, it's not that difficult to have access to the proper food. But, you know, there still are food deserts everywhere to some degree in disadvantaged neighborhoods and so forth. That still needs to be addressed. The food insecurity, especially since the lockdown.
Yeah.
And people have lost their jobs. It's harder now.
It's skyrocketed since the lockdown.
There are more people online at the food pantries than ever.
It's skyrocketed since then, yeah.
Yeah. And the choices there aren't necessarily great, but it's still sustenance to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that can of cream corn may not be the best, but food.
Government cheese. Government cheese.
Government cheese, exactly.
It's like
when you're hungry, you're not asking what.
They would pull up the, you know, the 18 wheelers, and they throw the wheels of cheese off the back of the, you know.
Right, right. Oh, my goodness. But it is scary what they're recommending now for 13-year-olds and up with medications, bariatric surgery. Oh, my gosh. These growing bodies. Do you know in a teenage pregnancy is the only time in a woman, a full-grown woman who is pregnant, the nutrients will go to the fetus.
Preferentially, absolutely.
Preferentially. But in a teenage pregnant woman,
yeah,
it will not preferentially go to the fetus. It will go to the growing girl who was pregnant.
Interesting.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, yeah.
What is going to happen if you perform bariatric surgery on this growing person? The 13-year-old, this 14-year-old, this 15-year-old, what's going to happen to... I think the nutritious consequences
bone
will
density,
be way more severe
bone density
than in somebody who's already full grown.
It's a critical period for brain development, bone density, and so on.
Well, neurological development isn't complete until 20 years of age.
20 or
more.
Or
21,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What's going to happen to them?
Yeah.
I'm afraid of this, actually.
Okay.
It's frightening. It's frightening. And I would never recommend it to a nutritionist.
Yeah.
As a nutritionist, rather. I would never recommend it to anyone. And I'm hoping
However, I think you would work diligently with a patient who's undergone that procedure.
Oh, yes.
To address
sure
some
the...
of their liabilities.
Yes.
Because without a very guided nutritional approach, that can really create a lot of health liabilities.
Exactly. I mean, we know in adults who have undergone the procedure well into adulthood, the deficiencies that continue to plague them, despite their very good nutrition.
Well, we have a couple of really amazing success stories. People who've lost more than half of their body weight, like two-thirds of their body weight, and they embrace the lifestyle. Yep. Maybe some of them are listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
And, you know, occasionally I hear from a couple of them because they're doing so well that they no longer check in. But with the right nutritional supplementation, the right diet, the right behavioral stuff, the right spiritual stuff, because you really have to, you know, you have to kind of overcome your hungry brain, you know, which is looking for gratification. And then with proper exercise, you can sustain the benefits. But, you know, I just talked to somebody and the men in social, he was a patient, I think. Anyway, so he was saying, my fiance underwent bariatric surgery, but she seems to be gaining all the weight back, not good.
Not good at all. The other thing is I still have trouble wrapping my head around a bariatric surgery procedure, which the only way that you feel that you're going to lose weight is to, if you eat beyond a certain point, 500 calories a day, 800 calories a day, whatever it may be, you're going to vomit. This can't be the way.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a joyful life.
Yeah, but it's a risk-benefit equation because actually, if you can demonstrate that these people are less likely to die of heart disease, diabetes, or obesity-related things, then you're taking a risk, but you are achieving a benefit. And this is not for routine, like people a little overweight. This is for people who are so
overweight. Those are the people who must have 3 or 4 breakfast sandwiches when one will do.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Those people, I get it. To some degree, it is psychiatric, I believe.
Totally.
The act of overeating, the same as with anorexia, not eating enough or not taking in enough.
Anyway, it's a complex problem. Okay, what we'll do is let's take a couple of questions and then we'll go to a break for part two. Mm-hmm. And part two, we'll consider more questions. We ran a little long on this segment because it's a big issue.
It's important, yeah. So we've got a question for Michael. Actually, we have a couple of questions about AMPK. He says, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman-Layla. I would appreciate your views about the use of AMPK. Here's a summary of the results of a study about how it enhances mitochondrial function and exercise benefits." Now, we know that AMPK, it has a role in kind of modulating mitochondrial activity, the essential mediator of the cycle of fragmentation and repair of the mitochondria, the specialized structures, organelles inside every cell responsible for producing energy. Now, here's the thing. AMPK can be enhanced by exercise. It increases with regular vigorous exercise.
Mm-hmm.
The beneficial effect on exercise on AMPK, however, may vanish in the elderly, and I think this is the point of Michael's question.
Uh-huh.
But there are other...
Which is interesting because, benefits of diet, exercise, certain supplements do decrease the older you get, and sometimes there's a point of no return. AMPK is a switch
That's kind of an energy switch, but it also impacts inflammation and longevity. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing, and there are natural ways to enhance it. I guess they're looking for drug ways to kind of get in there.
Well, there's one drug that can help enhance it, and it's metformin.
Metformin does that, That may be one of the reasons why metformin exerts an anti-aging effect and a longevity effect, although that's not entirely proven. I listened to an entire podcast for 2 hours to one of the guys who is doing the metformin research, Dr. Nir Vasile, who's at my medical school, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Hmm. And at the end, you know, he says, well, we really don't know.
Yeah.
We really don't know. But he believes in it. He takes it himself.
Yeah.
And he's conducting studies to look at its potential to extend life.
Another way to enhance AMPK, although I don't know if this would go down as we age, is calorie restriction.
Yep. Caloric restriction. Yeah. And
that's
we'll rev up here. Yeah.
So they're looking for, I guess they're looking for the drug too.
Right. Now there's, there's a claim that certain nutraceuticals are AMPK builders or supporters. I think that the evidence on that is somewhat limited.
Yes.
Certain herbs.
There are certain natural agents. There's some Chinese herbs that may be helpful, but I think it needs more, warrants further review.
But in the meantime, you know, I think exercise is one of the most plausible ways for doing it.
If there is a fountain of youth, I've even told our patients, if there is a fountain of youth, I believe it's exercise. In particular, I say to our older patients, strength training, because it'll keep them from becoming feeble.
I'm doing more of that myself. And,
you know, we have to give equal time to it as we get older.
If it prevents me, you know, because it's only a limited amount of time you can exercise, a limited amount of energy you have to exercise, and, you know, sometimes you suffer from injuries. If there should come a time where I can't, you know, compete in triathlons, I would just be happy to do a balanced program of, you know, a lot of aerobics, which I enjoyed, but also, you know, not to skimp on the strength training, because I think that strength training is helpful. And what's interesting about strength training is you can improve your strength and you can create a lot of benefits in your body without getting big.
That's true.
I mean, if your goal is getting big, there are ways of getting
big. Women don't get big.
Right.
First of all, we don't have the testosterone.
Yeah, that's part of it. That's why you also can't get a six-pack. You can do like, you know, 12,000 crunches, and you still won't have a six-pack.
Right.
Because you got estrogen.
Unless you're doping or something.
And you've got estrogen, that's going to give you some curves, you know, and some subcutaneous fat.
Yeah.
So anyway, so, but yes, let's...
And that added muscle, that increased muscle mass, just torches more calories.
Yes.
You know?
Metabolically
healthy. And the benefit is you can... And you'll be fine.
Yep.
Because it's your metabolism that's going in to supercharge.
One of my incentives, because I don't want to eat less.
Exactly. I know marathon runners, Dr. Hopman, I'm sure you do too, who are marathon runners so they could eat a pint of Haagen-Dazs every night. I've known such people anyway.
And drink quite a few beers too.
That's true.
There is a tendency.
Alcohol and exercise doesn't go. Mm-hmm. But some people do. I've known some smokers who go to the gym every morning at 5 a.m. I don't understand how that works, but hey, got it to work, but hey, good for them.
Apropos of which, I just read, there's an article, scientific article, on how a great recovery drink is not beer, but alcohol-free beer. It's rich in hops.
Oh, Duels or something.
Right, which it's rich in hops, which is anti-inflammatory. And it's got, you know, a little bit of calories and some good recovery drink. It's like, I've got some in the refrigerator out in the house in the country. I'm going to go for some this weekend, I think.
Very, very.
But first, I got to do the workout.
Yeah.
And it's going to be cold. All right. Let's take a break because we exceeded our allotted time for part one. In part two, give us a preview of what we're going to tackle.
It's actually another question from Michael again about nicotinamide riboside.
Okay.
How many milligrams is the question?
All right. When we return, more of your questions come to questions@drhopman.net. Remember, they can be questions, they can be comments. We like to hear about everything you're concerned with. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla.